From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this very special episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, The Best of Reunions, Part 3. This is the last of three special episodes to mark what would have been our annual Veterans Reunion. It was due to COVID-19 restrictions and with huge regret that Bletchley Park had to take the decision not to hold this year's reunion. But here at the podcast, we can still celebrate our amazing veterans with these special episodes. At a reunion, we like to capture as many veteran stories as we can, but we also always remember that it's their special day and we try not to interrupt it too much for them. Some chats might just be a quick hello and how are you, and some might end up with a short interview. But for some veterans, it might be the first time they've even been asked to talk about their vital war work. And so we're always honoured to be on hand, to record their stories and save them for future generations. In this, the last of these special episodes, we're bringing you nearly 80 minutes from another 12 of our amazing veterans, including a few of those longer interviews. And as we didn't get a chance to say it in person, we'd like to just take this opportunity to thank all of the veterans of Bletchley Park and its outstations for their service.
Bletchley Station! Bletchley Station!
Okay, we're almost ready.
We're ready for our close-up.
I know, come on. Okay, can everyone look in here, please? Nowhere else, all up here. Okay, that's perfect. Now everyone smile, please. Let's have a look. Oh, it's rather good. Hang on, another one. And then last one. There we go. Thank you very much, thank you.
Just before everyone moves.
Hang on.
Just before everyone moves, can I just say, on behalf of Bletchley Park, how proud and honoured we are to have all our veterans with us today. Can I just ask everyone to give us three cheers for the veterans, to say thank you for their service and for keeping that secret for all those years. Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
I'm Doris Moss. I worked at Bletchley Park and Hut 4 and Hut 6. I deciphered messages in Italian and we had translators to do it.
Doris, I've been told that you've got a fascinating story that starts before you even get to Bletchley Park.
Oh, yes, yes, I did. My father married a Belgian girl, lady. He worked in France, so we lived in France till I was 7, and then I went to Belgium because my father went to England in the army during the war. And we had to leave Belgium because of the bombing, and the Germans might have put us in a concentration camp, my sister and I, you see. So we took a train all the way down to the south of France. And on the way down, in the train, we were bombed by the Germans. That was my mother, my sister, and I.
So this was 1940?
1940. And a dog.
What was the dog's name?
Rita. She was a Cocker Spaniel. We left her in the south of France, actually. Oh. And so we took a train, and we were bombed while we were in the train. But they didn't get the station. They came later on in the evening and got the station. Mm. And then they took us out of the train and made us walk to the next station. The Germans came over with their aeroplanes, so we all lay down flat on the ground. And when they'd gone, we left, went up to the next stop, and we went on another train through Spain up to Lisbon, and that's where we stayed. And when we got to Lisbon, a ship left with some of the refugees, but we were not on the list because we came too late. And that was sunk with all hands on deck.
Oh, good Lord.
So they decided, the British government decided to have a big ship. We went in Lisbon for 4 months, and then we went to Gibraltar, and there we waited for a big ship to take us back to England. And it was a Polish ship, and we got to England after 6 days in a Polish ship. But in the Polish ship, we were told to put our passports and our names and stand by the lifeboats because we were going through a minefield. So, of course, that's another escape. And then we ended up in Southampton. And from Southampton, we went to Shortlands, where my uncle lived. And he knew somebody. We wanted to join the Wrens, but we couldn't. So he knew somebody in Admiralty. So we had an interview in Admiralty in 1942 with Mr. Birch, Frank Birch.
Oh, really?
It was Frank Birch. Ah. That's right, yeah. And we got to Bletchley Park in Hut 4 and then Hut 6.
So when you got to England, did you just want to do your bit to fight against the Germans?
Well, we thought we'd have to do something, didn't we? So we thought the best thing was to try to... And we went to Bletchley Park. That's how we got to Bletchley Park.
Because I suppose, really, more than most of our veterans at Bletchley Park, you'd actually witnessed the Nazis firsthand, hadn't you?
I did, yes.
And that must have given you a real momentum to want to do something.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So did you have any idea... Well, obviously, I know what the answer to this question is going to be. You had no idea what you were going to do when you got here, did you?
Not a clue.
So do you remember those early days? What happened?
Well, we were very, very shy, my sister and I, you know, and so because we didn't speak that good English.
So did your sister start with you here as well?
Yes.
All right.
And we were billeted in the village of Menton Keynes with Captain Grain and his wife, who said, if you can't speak the King's English, don't speak at all.
Oh.
So I learned the grammar from him. Opposite to and different from and all that jazz. So I could speak proper English. I still had the accent, of course.
You've got a beautiful accent. Well,
if I try, I might do better, but I can't be bothered to try. I mean,
so tell me where you worked in Bletchley, and do you have any memories of what you actually did?
Yes, I do. Hut 4. Mavis Beatty used to decipher messages on the Enigma machine.
Yes.
And she passed it on to me.
Ah, right.
My sister worked on the haggling machine.
Yes.
Because John Alexander collected the haggling machine, and he's the one who first interviewed us in Bletchley Park.
Right.
You see, he came to my house.
So you had all the important people interviewing you then, didn't you?
Yes, he came to my house.
What was your day-to-day work in Hut 4?
Well, we worked, as you know, we worked shifts. So I just deciphered messages in Italian with these block things, you know, 5 letters, another 5 letters, and you move them along, and you get a message.
So
it's all in the book.
So you were hand-breaking these ciphers. You weren't using a machine to break these. You were using your brain.
Well, no, I wasn't using my brain at all. I was not using my brain. Anybody could have done it. I know my sister said we were decoders, but we were not decoders. We deciphered messages. I did decipher. She was on the haggling machine, but I deciphered. Took over from Mavis Beatty.
Well, bearing in mind that Mavis Beatty was one of our code breakers, and if you took over from Mavis Beatty, you were deciphering messages.
I think anybody could have done it.
Well, not everybody did do it, so... Oh. So you take that as a compliment,
Oh,
Doris.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I know my sister thinks she's done it, but she wasn't even on it. She was on the haggling machine.
And did you do that for the whole time you were here?
Yes, I did. Then I went to the Japanese section.
Oh, really?
When the European War.
Yes.
Then I went to the Japanese section, starting to... They wanted me to learn Japanese. I mean, I know the word... for Liverpool, which is Ribapur, but that's about all I know. And then we went to London in 1947 to help with the history of the naval war.
Oh, right. So working on the official histories?
Yes, but as proofreaders. Proofreaders. So we worked there till 1947. Then I went back to Bedford and I worked in a bank there. Then I met my husband and we went back to live in Northampton after we've, because he was promoted within the office. Yeah. Normally he moved from one place to the other before he married me, you see. He was in Bedford and then he was promoted to Northampton and there he stayed.
And where do you live now?
Northampton.
Do you know what? So do I.
You don't.
I do. I live in Northampton. So what are your memories of being here? Do you enjoy being here?
I did. I was never bored. People said they were bored. I was never bored.
Well, no, you were doing something very special. That's why, I think.
That's probably why, yes. And then, I mean, anybody could have done it.
You say that.
Tell you, yes, I do.
You see, in all the years I've been doing this, I've never heard one veteran brag about what they did. You're all so modest. It's amazing. And thank you so much for today.
You're quite welcome.
For this interview. And can I just say thank you for your service?
Yeah. All right, then. I must tell my family now. I've got my youngest son came last year with me, and I've got my oldest son as well now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much,
Doris. Okay, you're quite welcome.
Well, I'm Molly Newtzel now. I was Molly Brewster, and I worked in Hut 7, apparently, on the Japanese section. Yes, that's all I know, really, but I only knew that after I came here.
And your name's up on the wall tonight?
Yes, and my sister.
And your sister was here
my
as well,
my sister was
she?
Here for 3 years of the war, and I was only here the last almost a year, not quite a year.
What do you think about the war? Do you think it's a good idea? And
well, I think it's rather nice to be remembered, because it will be there for a long time, the war, well, I expect, won't
you'll
it?
You'll be here forever, won't you? You thought you only came to do a little bit of service,
that's right,
here, and yes, you're going to be here
right,
for good.
Yes, absolutely.
Have you been to the reunion before?
Yes, I've been the last 3 or 4 years, actually, because
right.
I quite enjoy coming.
We must have missed you then.
We're a VIP for the day, you see, aren't we?
You're a VIP every day of the
no,
year.
No, I'm not.
All of the veterans are to us.
Oh, well.
But yes. It's good that you will be remembered forever, won't you?
It is rather and good, yes. Because nobody heard of us for 30 years, no. You see, did they?
No.
That's and the point, really.
I mean, I think that's a thing that a lot of people don't think of.
No.
Well, you not only did your service in World War Two. In a way, you carried on your service until the 70s, didn't you? Because
absolutely.
You kept that secret.
Yes, nobody knew. Didn't think about it. And even my sister and I, after the 30 years, we never spoke to it together. Hardly at all. I didn't even know which hut it was in.
No.
I didn't
you
even know.
You wouldn't, would you?
No.
There's so many veterans that I've spoken to, whether you feel the same, because you got to the end of the war and you'd given up a certain amount of time of your lives.
Well,
you just
it changed
to carry
my
on
life totally.
You just wanted to kick,
absolutely,
like, start your
totally.
Life, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of people just wanted to go off and get married and have children, and others went to get an education, but it was, right, we're not going to talk about it, because we just want to get on with things.
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, can I say thank you so much for your service, and have a lovely day today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the obvious then. What's your name? I know I can see it. But
Pamela Forbes.
And so what did you do?
I was in Hut 6.
Hut 6. And what were you doing?
Enigma.
Right.
Machines.
So you were at the very heart of it, really, right here at
without knowing it. Without knowing it, yes.
How old were you when you came here?
19, I think.
Do you remember it very clearly?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I do, very much.
So how did you join up? How were you recruited?
I was a Wren. I was a Wren, and I got my call-up papers and was sent here.
And was this far from home?
I lived in London. It wasn't
so
too bad.
You could go home to visit. That's not too bad.
Well, no, not really. You weren't encouraged to do that.
Weren't you?
No. Well, you couldn't tell anybody what you were doing, so actually it was easier not to go. Well, you've got all the questions.
And do you remember meeting lots of people here and having quite a good time outside shifts?
I don't know. I mean, when I was thinking about coming up today, I thought, I'll never remember anybody who was here with me. You know, we were very much a closed shop as such, because you couldn't speak to anybody.
So you didn't dare say, well, what do? What hut are you in? So you never knew.
No. You only probably really only got to know
you only got people, you, people you were working with. That's
and
right.
Of course, there'll only be a handful of them.
That's right.
So you don't know if they're here today.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Did you stay in touch with anybody afterwards?
For a little. But, you know, all things come to an end at some time or other.
So yeah. What's your memory of what it was like to work here? How would you describe it?
It was just different. You were in another world. And so you sort of went along with the form of what you could do, you know. It was slightly boring because you didn't know what you were doing. Which, having read about it now, you wished you had, you know.
Yeah, of course. At the time, you only knew what you needed to know.
You only knew what you needed to know, and they didn't tell you very much of that.
And so at the time, would I be correct in guessing you didn't really realise how important it was?
No, except you couldn't tell anybody. So I presume that was important.
And when did you start to get a picture of what kind of the significance of the contribution?
Oh, I suppose when it all started breaking in the press.
And were you surprised?
Until then,
by
I didn't know. Very, yes. About the whole picture. Very surprised.
You'd have thought you were just going to keep that secret with you forever.
I hoped I wasn't going to keep it forever, but, you know, you learn to not speak about it.
And did you feel different when you could speak about it?
Not really. Not really. I only spoke about it to people who were slightly interested.
What about now? Do you tell people now?
People have slightly forgotten, I think. Slightly forgotten. No, I don't tell anybody anything unless they ask.
I tell a lot of people.
Do you, darling?
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Pamela's daughter, Amanda.
Hello, Amanda. Hello. Thank you for being here.
I remember my mother telling me one day, out of the blue, in the 1970s it was, and she told me about this place, Bletchley. I knew nothing about it at all.
Well, you wouldn't.
I didn't know absolutely anything.
No,
she told me that during the war she used to, used to tell me what you told your parents. Clean out the...
Yeah, well,
clean
I did.
Out,
I did
out
to
the loos.
When I first joined up the rent, I did clean out the loos.
Was that a Tully Hewan Castle by any chance?
Yes, it was.
Yes, I've heard about this.
Yes. Yes, it was. It was obviously that's where we were pushed.
They were watching you the whole time,
that's right.
Weren't they?
Yes, yes.
Somehow you got chosen for this, and I bet you don't know why.
You don't know why at all. I got chosen to look after the knits, and I didn't know what a knit was.
Wow, that sounds very prestigious.
No, you learned. You learned. You grew up, actually, very quickly.
And so do you quiz your mother about it now?
I do, yes. She
doesn't give much away.
She's very reluctant to talk about it.
Yeah.
But if you know, when I ask questions, you know, and especially people who are interested, she opens up. But otherwise, no. I mean, your biggest regret was not being able to tell your parents.
Yes, it was terrible. It was terrible not to tell them. Because they wondered what earth you were doing at Bletchley, of all places, and you couldn't say I was near the sea.
You might have had a little bit of a dark fear that they didn't think you were contributing very much.
I don't think I was up to all sorts of nefarious doings.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Especially as your father was an old contemptible, wasn't he?
Yes,
he
yes.
You know, was one of the first to go into the First World War.
Yeah.
Very proud of his legacy there.
Yeah. It's quite an act to follow, isn't it? I suppose then it comes around, it starts happening again, and you feel like you've got your responsibility to do your bit. Well, and you did your bit, though. And
I
you
did
know
my
that
bit.
Now.
I did my bit. And I married a man whose father was an admiral of the fleet. And I remember going for lunch there. And it was, Pam, what did you do during the war? And I was saying, oh, my God, what I said. I said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you.
How did that go down?
Quite well.
Oh, good
quite
for
well.
Him.
I think he might have known.
Well, if he was in the know.
Yes.
He was Admiral of the Home Fleet at the beginning of the war. So
then I should think he knew,
Yes.
Then he knew of its existence and how important it was. And,
So there we are.
Wow. Thank you for coming back. Thank you more so for talking to us today. Is this the first time you've been to
No, I have been up here a couple of times. It's the first time I've been to a reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'll know anybody who's here.
Well, by the time you leave, you will.
Will I?
That's it. Keep chatting. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so
much.
Lovely
to
meet you.
Thank you.
What are you doing? Are you recording something?
Yeah. No, what do you think I'm doing?
Well, I don't know. I never know with you. He lurks, doesn't he?
Well, I'm lurking now.
I see. What do you want me to say? Have I enjoyed the day?
Yes. You don't need us to ask you any questions, do you? Have you enjoyed today?
Very much indeed. Especially as Doris Moss sought me out. I hadn't seen her since we did the TV thing in Manchester.
Oh, yes.
Mm, yes, it was nice to see her again.
Remind me, what was the TV thing in Manchester?
It was Doris and me talking about experiences of Bletchley, as far as I can remember. It's not likely to have been anything else, is it?
Well, no, but were you live on something?
Yes, yes, it was the early morning thing from Salford.
Oh, was it?
It was great fun. The only thing was we had to be up by 8:30 in the morning. It was a very lengthy business. We went the night before.
Yeah. Betty, you almost weren't sure whether you were going to make it today, were you? How determined were you to get here today?
Totally.
It's an important day in your calendar, isn't it?
Absolutely. Good Lord, I wouldn't have missed it. Well, if the doctors had said no, I obviously would have had to have abided by it, but no.
I don't believe her. I think she'd have come anyway.
She's actually lying about what doctors have told her. And now we're talking about you as if you're not here.
Because what you're failing to tell people, Betty, is that you've just had a major operation in the last 2 weeks, haven't you?
Yes, I have. It was on Monday, well, 3 weeks tomorrow, isn't it?
From now on, you're going to be known as Bionic Betty, aren't you?
If that's what you'd like to call me, yes.
And had to persuade her to use the chair because she was all set to use the trolley, weren't you, as much as possible?
Yes, the trolley is a sort of shopping trolley, which I found very useful. Yeah. I can walk around the house without any help, but I realise I mustn't run before I can walk, so to speak.
Run around Bletchley Park. It's bigger than you think, isn't it?
Well, yes.
That's the thing that was my concern. It's not sort of the pottering around. It was the journeys between sort of stops, really.
And that also I'm a little bit unsteady on rough ground.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of rough ground.
Well, inevitably, yes.
So you've been doing the rounds a bit today, haven't you? And we're going to see you in a few interviews after today.
Yes, quite a few, yes.
Yes, are you ready for a cup of tea?
I'd love something, yes, yes. All right, then. Well, should we go down again?
Yes.
I think perhaps we'll
I have Elizabeth Davis with me. Now, Elizabeth, where did you serve during World War II?
In Hut 7.
And what did Hut 7 do for those listeners who don't know?
It was, I think, all Japanese naval codes. But I can't be sure because we didn't go into anybody else's office.
No.
You just went into your own office and you did what you had to do. And you didn't really know what went on anywhere else, which made it less interesting, really, than it should have been. I've met people after the war at reunions and so on, which have explained to me what I was doing.
We interview a lot of Wrens, and today we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of the ATS.
Yeah.
But you're neither of those, are you? You were actually working for the Foreign Office.
I was recruited from Oxford University as a Foreign Office civilian, yes.
So what were you studying at Oxford?
I was studying science subjects, but that didn't seem to be really part of it.
I think they probably just wanted you for your brains, didn't they?
That's about it, I think. Such as they were, yes.
So how did the recruitment come about?
Well, I think that there was a group of people, I've learned this since, in Balliol College, who were responsible for spotting people that might be useful, but I don't know. I've also read somewhere that they rather liked somebody who'd only done a year and not got stuck into sort of... that they wanted people who were very open-minded.
Oh, right, yeah. Did you have an interview? Or?
Yes, I do remember a rather cadaverous man, and I think he was at Balliol College, one of somewhere. I really got the impression that I didn't have much option. I mean, I was quite happy. I hadn't really enjoyed my course and had spent most of the time acting and directing plays. So I wasn't too broken-hearted to give that up. We were told that our places would be kept for the end of the war.
So what year was this that you were at Oxford?
1943 to 1944, and then I came to Bletchley.
And what age were you then?
I must have just had my 20th birthday.
Right.
A little bit beyond 20.
So you felt when you had the interview that you didn't really have a choice, really?
No, I mean, you were called up at 18. I was lucky to have had a year at Oxford.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of my friends didn't get that. They were called up, you know, when they were 18.
Mm.
I was given a remission of a year.
And did you have any idea at all what you were going to be doing, or were you just told to come here?
None. We were told we were Foreign Office civilians, and that's what we were to say to anybody else. Secret work for the Foreign Office, I think, was the sort of formula.
Yeah.
Secret work for the Foreign Office. And then you were given a train ticket, a train warrant, to Bletchley. And you got on the train and arrived at Bletchley.
We hear that from so many veterans.
Yes.
No idea.
No.
Probably didn't even know this place existed.
Oh, no.
I just got a railway chit to go to Bletchley.
That's
and that
it.
Was the start of it.
Yes.
Your actual work in Hut 7, did you do any training beforehand, or were you thrown straight in?
Yes, I had a week's indoctrination, as it were, up in the block, the naval block.
Hmm.
Block A, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. I had a week there. I had a very severe interview in the mansion, I think with Mr. de Grey, about secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to sign the Secrets Act. And I also had a month's Japanese course.
In
Bletchley.
Oh.
I can't remember where. I think somewhere in the buildings behind Hut 7. But that was a month. And we had to start in the traditional way with learning our characters, Chinese characters, of course.
Yeah.
And painting our cards with the different characters.
Yes.
And then learning the kana.
We did an episode all about the Japanese school
really?
In Bedford. So all these things that you're telling me, I've been told of by our archivist.
Well, that's...
And you're living proof of it.
Yes. And I think the tutor, he had been, I think, in the embassy in Tokyo.
Hmm.
I don't know if you can identify him. Could his name have been Lloyd? He was also a published poet, I think.
Oh.
So I was told, but I'm not sure.
So when you actually got into the day-to-day work, can you remember what you were doing?
We were working on the JN-40 most of the time, and then occasionally I would be lent to another office in the hut working on the JN-25, which was, I think, the Naval High Command, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think so.
That was quite a complicated one, probably similar to some of the German codes.
Mm. Oh, yeah. We found out about the German build-up for D-Day because we read
exactly.
the Japanese embassy's messages back
yes,
to their
yes.
homeland, telling us all about the visit
yes.
they just had to Normandy. What was your physical day-to-day job?
Well, on the usual one, the JN-40, we worked on squared paper, all piled up ready for us. Somebody somewhere must have been tearing up those standard school books.
Hmm.
Well, you know, they came in lined paper and squared paper.
And grid paper, yeah.
Grid paper. We had piles of these squared papers to work on. I can't remember the details. We must have laid it out in the squares, and they were quite low-grade shipping, quite small ships, and they changed every week.
Hmm.
You had to break them at the beginning of the week, and, of course, you had to have enough signals come in to work on.
You so you were doing this by hand then?
Yes,
just by hand breaking.
Absolutely. Just with a pencil.
That's amazing.
A pencil and a bit of squared paper.
That's remarkable. I mean, there's not many people around now who were hand breaking ciphers.
I suppose not.
That's fantastic. I mean, did you have any idea what you were doing?
Well, we knew that we were breaking signals from ships. What we didn't know, and I only learnt after by meeting people at reunions, actually, was that this information was going to the translators, the genuine translators. We only knew enough to recognise words so that we knew when we had broken the code, like submarine, sensuikan. When these words came up, we knew we were there. But those signals that we interpreted, giving positions of ships, positions of sightings of submarines, were all going to a hut, which the Wrens were in charge of. And I met a Chief P.O. Wren at a reunion who was in charge of this map room. And those ships were all being plotted in this map.
Yes.
That would have been terribly interesting to me at the time. I mean, I didn't know who was going to get my signals when I decoded them.
You see, that's funny. It's I suppose you don't think of your job as being important when you're doing it, and you think of the other person, oh, they've got this great big map, that must have been brilliant. But your job was more important because you were giving them the information to put on there.
And then our decoded signal went to the translators, and then they were sent on to strategic people. Positions of ships were plotted on the maps in the map room and probably in the Admiralty in London. The strategic people in Hut 6 decided who needed to know this in the field.
That's
and so some of our decodes were going straight to the field, and the ships that we were able to plot were being sunk as a result. Mm. I didn't know that.
No, you wouldn't.
No.
So how long were you here then?
A year.
A year. And were you here right up to the end of the Japanese War?
No, we were allowed to apply for redundancy after the end of the European War.
Oh, really?
Because so many people from the European War wanted to stay on.
Yeah.
And they were probably more experienced codebreakers than we were. And I got plans. I wanted to go into the theatre. And so I applied for redundancy and I began writing to theatre schools and theatre companies. And so I went straight from Bletchley into the Donald Wolfage Shakespeare Company.
Oh.
He was on tour at Nottingham. Mm. And I hitched down from Bletchley with all my belongings to Nottingham and joined the Donald Wolfage Shakespeare Company.
And so did you carry on as an actress?
Yes, until I became a naval wife and had to tour around the world and also a mother of four children eventually. And so I left the theatre at that point and then retrained as a drama teacher when my children were young and taught for 10 years. And then you had to retire at 60, and so I went back in the theatre when I was 60.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And you
and
still
I retired last year.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant.
Yes. I've had a long career.
A long and very fulfilled career by sounds of it. Well, it's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you, Elizabeth, and thank you so much. And to meet someone who was doing such a specific job as you were.
Yes,
it's fantastic.
I don't know whether somebody presented me with those codes, whether I could put them out on a bit of squared paper. Now, I've no idea.
Well, I don't think we're going to ask you now.
How we set them out.
No.
Or, you know, it's just gone.
I always find it remarkable. I mean, You know, I can't remember things that I did in a job that I did 10 years ago.
That's it.
I mean, to think back 75 years.
Your brain can probably only hold the things it needs, and you don't need that. It's the same with a play. If you're playing repertory, which I did in the early days, weekly repertory, you can't hold all the plays in your head on Saturday night. You wipe it clean.
Because you were doing a different play every week,
yes,
weren't you?
Yes.
If you were a touring company, especially, weren't you? Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, and I hope you have a lovely day today.
I will, I'm sure. It's a lovely weather for us, isn't it?
Very you deserve
fortunate.
It.
Very fortunate. Nice to have met you.
Marigold Angela McNeely was Bostock Wilson.
Diana Lloyd.
And what were you with before you were married?
Tyler.
And so what did you do? I worked on the bomb in Hut 11. And I was stationed at Woburn Abbey and also Crawley Grange. And I have an invitation from the Duchess to go and look around Woburn today.
Oh, how lovely.
So I'm really looking forward to it.
So that's your next stop?
Yes.
And so this isn't the first time you've been back to visit?
No, 3 years ago we came to Bletchley. You were here at Bletchley 3 years ago too. Right?
3 years ago. Yeah. Yes, we've got the photo, haven't
yes.
we?
Did you know each other during the war or afterwards?
We didn't work together.
No.
But
we met after the war. We were stationed at HMS Royal Arthur, which was at Corsham, while Prince Philip was there. And she and I were talking about, we had mixed hockey.
With Philip.
With Philip.
Yes.
And he was very mean. He bashed, I don't care, I'm American now. Yeah. He did. He bashed the girls of the Wren's legs to get the ball away from them.
So there's a touch of equality about that, isn't there? But I'm not sure it's the most gentlemanly thing. Maybe he was treating you like one of the boys.
Yeah, well, we had fun. We had to sit in the back of the lorry, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
To get there.
Yes. We were transported in the back of lorries.
In the back of a lorry.
Yes.
It must be nice for you two to be able to get back together again.
Oh, it's been lovely.
Yes. I'm 90. How old are you?
90.
We're both 90.
And you live in the States?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
In Louisiana, just north of New Orleans.
So you don't presumably get back to the UK?
No.
Too many
3 years ago. Yeah. That was the last time, yes. Yes. But Diana came. We used to have a farm in Louisiana, and Diana came and spent Christmas with us in Louisiana.
Yes, it was lovely.
How long are you back over for this time?
2 weeks.
Well, it's wonderful that you can get together and
I know,
make new memories.
We have such memories.
Yeah. Did you tear the town up when you were younger?
We did. She wanted to know if we tore the town up. We got into all kinds of trouble.
Yeah. And where? In London?
Yeah. In London and at Corsham.
Yes.
And Diana was just telling them I was the first and only captain's defaulter because I got drunk and disorderly. We were selling poppies for November the 11th, is that Veterans Day?
Yeah.
She and I were going around the camp selling poppies. This was after the war. And everywhere we went in the petty officer's mess, they gave us a tot of rum, which was very strong navy rum, wasn't it?
Yes.
Then we couldn't get back on our bicycles, which were falling off. The poppies were going everywhere. And
disgrace.
We were disgraced. Yeah. And when I went to the captain's cabin, or where it was, I decided that he needed this great big, I think not plastic, wax poppy in his buttonhole. And of course, when I tried to put it on him, he smelled all the whiskey that I've been drinking. And that's why I was captain's defaulter.
Oh, dear. But you got away with it.
Yes, she did.
I'm hearing nothing from you. I think you were there too, weren't you?
I was there too.
Were you falling off your bike as well?
Yeah, she was falling off, and all her poppies went everywhere too.
Everywhere.
But she didn't try and put the poppy in the captain's butthole.
You're not going to quite go to those lengths now, are you?
No.
Okay.
No,
okay, you're not going to get roaring drunk together now.
No.
I can't drink now.
No, I think none of us can quite drink what we did when we were 19, can we?
Exactly.
No.
I still like my cider because I'm from Somerset.
It's wonderful that you can get back together, and thank you for sharing part of your day with me.
Well, thank
you. Have a wonderful time at Woburn
sure
as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Margaret Thomas.
Margaret, you were a wren.
I was.
And you were at Bletchley Park. Yes. What was the start of that for you? Did you join up? Were you called up?
No, I was called up. I had the choice of going into Lutenitions or going into the Wrens. So, of course, that was a no-brainer. I went out to London and had one or two interviews. And I told them that I did lots of chess. I played lots of chess. And I think that sealed my fate.
Had someone told you to say that? Or
No. I was just asked what my interests were. And I couldn't think of anything else except I used to play with my Uncle John for hours on end. But,
oh, really?
Yes, so that's how that came out. Anyway, the next thing I knew, I was sent up to Tully Hill, which was in Scotland, and we had the sort of inaugural. And that was the day before Christmas, the 24th of December. And it was very cold and quite exciting, really, but it was very, very dark. Eventually, we were sent down to Bletchley Station, and we were taken, I think we went to Woburn Abbey that night, whereas where I lived, it sounds very grand, but actually...
It wasn't, was it?
No, it wasn't.
It was awful.
It was up in the servants' quarters, where it was cold, but it was quite fun, really. You know, we used to sort of chase around the big, long corridors. Because the loo was miles away. It was before they got all the ablutions in properly. And we used to dash along. There was supposed to be a ghost up there. So we used to tease each other, and ghost is coming, and off we'd go.
Was this the first time you'd been away from home?
No, I'd been away from home for a couple of years previously because I'd been evacuated.
Oh, had you?
Yes, to Crawley, which was just a little tiny village then. It wasn't, you know, so being away from home was no real problem at all.
Because a lot of the ladies will say to me, you know, yeah, it was the first time they'd been away from home. It was like a new adventure for them. You know?
Well, it was a new adventure, but it wasn't all that
grand.
New to me. No,
yeah.
Grand. So, yes, and then we came here, I think, and I had some tall friends, and they were about 5'6" or 5'7". And they will put on the bomb machines. And I was only 5'2" or 5'3", so I had to do all the... Oh, and it was so boring. The messages used to come in, and we used to have to type them on this machine, and it would go off somewhere. We knew not where. We never saw them again or what the result was. I know far more about it now than I did then.
So were you testing the settings after the bomb operator?
I don't know. It might have been. It might not have been. I really, really don't know. All I know is that we settled out on these sheets of five letters and just typed them in the machine. On and on.
Were you on a teleprinter?
I don't know. It was a very big machine. That's bigger than the ones we see here.
I think it was a teleprinter.
Yeah.
Were they the handwritten ones?
No, they were. They were typed. I suppose they'd come in typed.
So they came in on type. Try and work out what you did.
Well, when you found that, do let me know.
You.
Yes, they must have had a lot of fun.
They could get on the train and
jump down to
London, couldn't
they? We used to have 2 or 3 days off. And then my friends and I, we used to do a bit of hitchhiking then. And one time we went right across to her house, which was miles away. And other times we did it to my house, which was only sort of more or less down the road because I was living in Pinner. Yes, so that was quite easy. And when the war was over, we were all at the front there. We were taken outside, you know, the big, big announcement that was going to be made. And then they said, oh, the war with Germany is over. Great cheers. And all the German people sort of cheered like anything. But we were on the Japanese one. Our faces drooped a bit, I think. And we toddled off back to work. So it was a bit of a...
And where were you working then?
What? Seven then.
Seven, yes.
Yes. And there I stayed until they dropped the atom bombs. And then after that, that was over for us, so that we were demobbed. It had its moments, and it was quite interesting from some points of view. I can remember looking out. I don't think we'd see through the window, but I'm lulling my life away here. I want to go and get on with it and have babies and, you know.
And actually start your adult life, wasn't it, really?
So eventually that's what we did.
When was it when you first started speaking about what you'd done? Was it quite late on?
Well, oh, yes. There was no one to talk to about it. You know, what could you say? I worked at Bletchley Park. Oh, did you? You know, that sort of thing.
I think that's the thing, because it was so compartmentalised here.
Yes.
None of you realised how important your little bit was.
No, I wish we had known a bit more, but it's not until sort of quite recently that I'm a very important person, I'm told.
You all are very, very important.
Yeah. And we were saving lives in a way.
Do you look back, are you proud of what you did?
I suppose in a way I am now more, yes. When people say, oh, no, that was good, and people shake your hand and say...
But you're all so modest about it, aren't you?
I don't know, but there's nothing to be grand about, you know.
That's what I love about all of our veterans. Mm-hmm. You're all, oh, well, I didn't do anything
that
important.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I didn't.
But, you know, the freedoms that we all have now are really down to you people.
Yes.
So can I just say thank you for your service?
Thank you. That's kind of you. Very kind of you.
You get quizzed and all that, yeah. So, it's been a good day. I'll have to come again when it's not a Veterans Day and look around a bit more and see what additions there's been made since last year or the year before, yeah.
Yeah, because there's been a few.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a good day for you all, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is, yeah.
And you've got your grandson here with you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. He's learned something.
So, proud family?
Very absolutely, proud, yes. Yeah, very proud.
I don't know why.
Oh, I think we all know why.
I tell you what, that photograph of taking Army and ATS, there was only two of us there. What's happened to it? I know our army has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk.
You're not made of the same stuff as those Wrens, are you?
Well, they were some goers there at Gayhurst. Oh, yeah.
Allegedly.
They used to come to the dances we held. Some of them were a bit prim and proper, but some of them were, you know, let their hair down.
So, another good year for you?
Well, yeah. 93 and a half, I suppose I can't complain. I count it in months now rather than years, you know.
That's what we like about you, Bartram. Oh, you always include the half, because that's important.
You see, I'm prepared. I've even got a tray, look, to put my food on.
Well, it's lovely to see you again.
All right, yeah.
And thank you again for your service.
Okay, all right. Nice to see you all.
Take care.
Oh, it's been a very good day. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very much.
Interview for the BBC as well.
Yes, yes. And this year it's been well organised, the whole thing.
Oh, lovely.
And the food on the count there, everything.
And where did you serve?
Hut 6.
You were in Hut 6?
I was in Hut 6. And it was just hectic. The main thing about it was that we all worked to death.
Yes.
First of all, I came here and it was wonderful. Lovely garden, lovely people, great atmosphere. It was wonderful. And I learned to do the job and the typing from Morse, and it was fine. As the pressure started to build up, it got to the stage when, just before D-Day, people were burning out, they really were.
Well, some of you had to go off and have rest, didn't you?
They had to go off and have 2 days rest with drugs
and
then go back and work again.
Yeah.
I mean, this was happening all around me and I stuck it out until D-Day. And after D-Day, I just went home. And unfortunately, nobody knew what had happened, but I went home and the doctor put me straight in hospital.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I was 3 weeks in hospital. And my parents hadn't got the address at Bletchley Park.
Yeah.
They'd only got my Bedford address.
Oh.
So they wrote to Bedford and Bletchley Park didn't know what had happened. They thought I'd done a runner. They really did. In the end, they just sent me my cards. They didn't send a thank you letter or anything. But I didn't care because I'd done my bit.
Yes. Well, you definitely did, didn't you?
Absolutely. And I mean, I'd worked myself to a bone on it. Okay. It was worth it.
more questions?
No, I just wanted to finish it off. So now we've sent you off on the right path, because I nearly sent you on the wrong path there. And you're going to go and look at a Typex shortly, aren't you?
Yes, that's right.
And what did you do with the Typex?
Well, I was working in a factory office, and the boss was a colonel, an old colonel. And he said, I think there's a job for you. And so I said, I don't want it, thank you. He said, it's for the foreign office. I said, I have no education much. Foreign office is not for me because I have no languages. He says, good. I wasn't winning. And he just said, will you go and have an IQ next door? And I had an IQ, came back, and he says, you've got the job and you're going. And I couldn't say no. I mean, I was had to go because I knew it was war work and important.
Yes.
So anyway, they put me on a train from Doncaster to where I lived, down to London, where somebody met me, put me in a car, took me around to Euston Station, and then a man met me again, another one, kept introducing themselves to me, and he says, come quickly because your train's in. And I said, what train? I've just come down by train. He says, no, he says, you're going up now. And get off at a place called Bletchley.
Which I bet you'd never heard of.
I've never heard of it. And what's more, there was no station announcements in those days. There was no labels on.
No, they'd taken them all down, haven't
they? The announcements were very infrequent, but there was just somebody said Bletchley, and I thought, oh, that's it.
And then in here and signed the Official Secrets Act, I bet.
Well, in here, and I did the course to learn to type from Morse.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, because I had to start from scratch. I mean, I was a typist, but
it's different,
it took
isn't
me
it?
A few weeks. There was about 30 girls in the group that went when I went. And within a week, it was down to 20. And gradually, for the next two or three weeks, it was going down. And 10 of us came in to do Hut 6.
They kept the cream.
Well, that's rather a nice thought. That's rather a nice thought, but it had to be we could do the job and we could do it steadily and not make mistakes, because one mistake and the whole message went corrupt. Yeah. It was very, 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 very brain work, really.
Yeah. And it was very
hard
important
going.
What you were doing.
Hard going. Well, this was the point. I pushed myself, particularly on the run-up to D-Day, and everybody else was the same in the department because we knew what we were doing and we knew it mattered. As we were typing, we said, well, every message might just have one little bit of information that's going to help. It's going to be the one that cracks it.
And it could be, it
was
true. Saving lives.
It was true. Yeah, it was true. So, I mean, it was really hard work. But when they announced that it was D-Day, I took myself out from Bletchley and I got in the train and went back up to Doncaster home. And, of course, the first thing, my mother hadn't seen me for nearly 2 years because I didn't go home at all in between. And she hadn't seen me. And she said, I think the Foreign Office has tried to kill you. I don't know what they've done to you. But she said, I'm calling in the doctor. And the doctor came and put me straight into hospital. And I was in hospital for 3 weeks. During that time, they wrote to the Bedford address. So nobody told the Foreign Office that why I'd left. So after 3 weeks, I got an envelope with my cards in. They just sacked me. First time I'd ever been sacked. But I didn't care. No. I thought, well, the war's over. I've done my bit. I'm here now. And I showed it to the people at the Labour Exchange and they were, you know, grumble, grumble, grumble about what the Foreign Office had done. And I said, look, the war's over. We've stopped it. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters. I said, I'm going to go and get married now.
Well, I'm glad you had a nice day today. Yeah. I'm glad you decided to come back. Because it's always good to see veterans here, and it's good that we can share your stories with people around the world.
It was a memory of a period of hard work, but it was worth it.
Oh, it definitely
was.
Every
bit.
Can I just say thank you for your service? Thank you so much.
It was just done. I was only young. I was 21 whilst I was here.
Bless you. Well, I'm glad you had a good day.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I had a passionate longing to contribute to the war effort. And it was a blessing to me when I had a letter from my brother suggesting that I go to London for an interview with a Miss Moore at the Foreign Office, who would probably be able to give me the sort of job I was looking for. I went to London, a bit of an innocent, with my suitcase.
Where did you come from?
I came from the south of England at that time. We were living in rented accommodation because my father being in the Navy, we didn't have a home of our own. We followed near wherever he went when we could. And it was my brother, John, who was, of all things, recovering from tuberculosis in South Africa, who wrote and suggested to me that this would be a wonderful thing for me to do, and he would put my name forward because he'd worked in communications in the British Navy, and he knew they were looking for staff at a place called Bletchley Park. So I was rather thrilled by this, went to London, and I had an interview. And 3 weeks later, I was on the train to Bletchley, where I was met by transport and taken to Buckingham in a shooting break by MTC drivers. And there was somebody there waiting for me who said, "Oh, you've been billeted up at the police station." There I was, billeted in the police station, not with the superintendent, as a friend I was with was, but with D.C. Slatter and his wife, Mrs. Slatter, who were an elderly couple. He was a retired policeman brought back for service to release younger men for the services. And there I was welcomed by this marvellous couple, Mr. and Mrs. Slatter. And she was the most wonderful cook, a lovely lady. And for 3.5 years, they welcomed me like a daughter. And I lived there very happily. Every day I walked from their police station down to the square, and transport would always be waiting there at a certain time, usually 8:30 in the morning, to take us from Buckingham into Bletchley to work.
I've been looking into a little bit about Miss Moore. I understand she was quite a formidable lady.
Quite a formidable lady.
Could you describe a little bit about her and a little bit more about your interview and the sort of questions you asked? You know,
yes.
Can you create a picture of that part of your interview?
I had been told that Miss Moore was perhaps rather severe and be very careful what I said and so forth. But I had a certain amount of confidence. I wasn't overconfident, but I just looked her straight in the eye and I answered her questions as straightly as I could, and we hit it off. I mean, I think I passed muster in that I was not shy and retiring, but I didn't overdo it, I hope.
No, I can see from what I understand, yeah, she would have liked somebody who was quite confident, quite, you know, direct. Look you in the eye.
Yes. She could have been formidable, but I got a smile out of her. And once you make people smile, you know you're moving in the right direction. I'm a great believer in breaking the ice. She asked quite a lot of personal questions about family life and whether I was adaptable. And she was very direct. I came away thinking to myself, that was an interview that didn't frighten me. So I thought that she must be a powerful lady who'd been used to doing interviews. I felt, well, I've done my best, and she knows all she needs to know, and I have just to wait and see.
Yes, well, she was the gatekeeper of women like yourself and passing, as you say, muster to decide their suitability. So.
Absolutely,
Did you have to do any sort of written tests, or was it simply an interview?
At one stage, whether it was before I had the interview with her, I think somebody dictated something to me, and I had to take it down and just type it out for them. That was about all.
So you arrived, you were billeted. Do you remember your first day of coming into Bletchley?
Yes, because you didn't really know where you were going to work. We were a pool of us, really. I think we were 24 of us who were new. And we got called out in twos and threes and had a private interview with somebody. And then you got sent on to somewhere else. And eventually, I got told then that I was to report to go and work in Captain Bradshaw's office. It was all administrative work, keeping lists of the people, who they were, their references.
So describe the average working day. Were you...
They were very long days.
Did you start at 9? You didn't do shifts?
No, 9 till 6. And 9 till 6 is quite a long time. We had an hour off for lunch, and we had about 15 minutes break, 11 o'clock.
And where did you get your drinks from during your break?
Somebody ran a sort of canteen, I suppose it was WRVS or something like that, just outside the gates. And I went from the house down to the gate and got myself a drink or a sandwich or whatever.
Were you in the mansion for your entire time?
Yes, I was. Or did we move out towards the end of my time there?
I understand there was a Hut 9.
It was a Hut 9, yes. You're absolutely right. I think I moved from Hut 9 into the mansion.
Oh,
I did it that way around.
Right, okay.
Yes, I was in Hut 9 first. And then Captain Bradshaw wanted me there, and he wanted me there all the time, so that if he slipped out to go somewhere, my office, which was in the summer house, next to the house, I could just go through the door and answer his phone.
And how many of you were in that office?
There was me, and then I had an assistant to help, because it was almost too much work for one. But that was all, just two of us. And the other person did financial things as well, did all the finance stuff. I didn't do the financial side of things. Sums were never my strong point. Yes, very much to do with the people and their where they lived and whether they were... Their welfare, really, too. And I kept an eye to make sure... Or I would make inquiries if you heard a rumour that somebody was having a miserable time.
In your oral history account that's on the Bletchley Park website, you also mentioned that you worked with Barbara Abernathy.
Abernathy, yes. I did indeed, yes. A wonderful character, Barbara, yes. I loved her dearly.
How?
Oh, she was just so outgoing and full of life and fun. A clever, clever person. And she married Joe Ekus, an American, an unlikely husband, because he seemed rather quiet and introspective, and Barbara was so very outgoing, but they were a very happy couple.
So what did you do for fun? Your shift ended at 6.
I joined a choir. I always loved singing, and sometimes we used to give concerts. I just loved learning the music, even if, we only gave a concert once in a while. You met a different group of people, and I loved singing, so I learned a lot, certainly, about them. And we used to give a Christmas concert always, too, which was fun. I did a little bit of acting if they were running short of people. I didn't want to get onto the stage set too much because it took up too much time. I used to play tennis sometimes, gobble my lunch.
Was there like a tennis club, or did you just sort of turn up and then...
You'd turn up, but then eventually you'd form a sort of group, and they had a board up. You could book your court the time you wanted to go. So,
so
it's yours
organized.
From that time. Yes, it was very well organised. Yes.
Can you describe a little bit about your office? So you would have had your desk, your assistant's desk. What other equipment? Would you have kept the personnel files
in there?
I had
a huge desk right across the window, and I had 5 telephones.
Wow.
I had my own telephone. I had a telephone to London, direct to London. I had a telephone direct to my boss. If he was on a call in the office, and I was in that summer house alongside, he would press a buzzer, which meant lift the thing, listen to what I'm saying, and keep a record of it. So I would be listening and writing shorthand of his telephone conversation.
Oh, I see.
So that at the end of the telephone conversation, after about 10 minutes, I could have typed it out and given him a record of what he had said, because he was very meticulous in making sure that everything was as it should be.
And where did you keep all the records, like the personnel files?
I had a filing cabinet alongside my desk.
Was it just one filing
cabinet? One big filing cabinet for all the personal stuff to deal with him. Behind me at the back was another one that had more Bletchley stuff in it concerning the park. Because eventually things got so big that I had 2 assistants working with me, and they worked the desks behind me and had that filing cabinet where I said my cabinet, my filing cabinet for him.
We hear a lot about the compartmentalisation of Bletchley, in that nobody knew what was going on. You would have been in a position to know a little more.
Well, I did, and Bradshaw knew my father was a senior naval officer, and he used to confide in me. So he was very kind in that way. That
and did you know anything about the work in the park?
A certain amount, more than probably I should have done.
Would you have got to know anything about operations such as like the upcoming D-Day, and because that would have involved an increase in staff?
Yes, yes.
So things like that.
Things like that. One was aware that it was building up. And I knew that both from what was happening at home with my two brothers in the Navy and my father, as well as the sort of buzz going on. And I had quite a lot of friends in the naval section, being a naval daughter, though they sort of took an interest, probably because my father was very senior.
Famous by association.
That's right.
And how did you find the burden of keeping the secrets and the fact that you would have known these extra things?
I don't think that worried me, because I'd been brought up in naval circles, and I think it was sort of a way of upbringing that, of course, you've signed the Official Secrets Act, so you don't talk about it.
No.
And we're just brought up that way, I think.
So if we sort of jump ahead a little bit then towards your end of your time, did you stay here till the end?
No, I moved to London because I had a letter from my brother saying that my husband-to-be, who I didn't know, of course, going to be my husband-to-be, he's coming back and he's going to be working in London. And he was terribly keen for me to meet this chap, who became my husband, in fact.
So did you meet him in London, or did you meet him here?
I met him in London, yes. He rang me up and said, I'm going to a dance in Oxford on Saturday night. Will you meet me for lunch on Sunday? And I thought to myself, you're a snake. What about, why am I asked to lunch, not to the dance? But his sister was at the university, and she hadn't got a boyfriend, so she knew he was home on leave, and she asked him to go. So we met like that. Silly story, but quite fun.
Oh, absolutely. So how did you feel about leaving Bletchley?
Oh, it's a bit of a wrench, really, because I'd sort of grown up a lot, you know, moved away from family life and become my own person, so to speak, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so you enjoyed that emancipation, that bit of freedom.
I did, because working for Bradshaw's, they were so nice. He had a terrible reputation of being gruff and difficult, so on. They were so nice to me and kind, and you know, I suppose I was a reasonably efficient secretary, otherwise I'd have been kicked out, so.
And what's your best memory of your time at Bletchley?
Oh, I think sitting by the lake eating sandwiches, just generally lovely sunny days like this, which we did have sometimes, and then you mixed up more, you met people from other huts, and you talked to people that you sort of wouldn't really otherwise talk to or meet. So, yes, you widened your horizons greatly by doing that. And then that meant probably you might meet socially, you know.
As you did with Barbara, going to see her in America.
Exactly.
Yeah, make lifelong
friends. Lifelong friendships, yes.
Nice to meet you.
Yes, and you.
And how are you today?
Oh, not too bad. This is my daughter here.
Hello.
Maureen.
You were in RSS, were you?
RSS. Yeah, it was Radio Security Service. Not Y Service.
No.
Don't you dare put Y Service on your thing, because I was RSS. We were civilians. We were recruited by MI5.
Yeah.
By MI5 agents.
Wow.
We were recruited by MI5. And then we were trained at Barnet, Hartley Barnet. And we had nothing to do with the Y Service. They were recruited from the Army, Navy and Air Force, not us. So that's why I'm looking for the other one all the time, you know.
Oh.
And we're sorry, you were going to ask something.
No, I was just going to say, were you in uniform?
Yes, yeah. What happened there we were recruited as civilians. When we had passed all the security thing, you know, it had to be top security. You realise that from Bletchley Park. And when we were interviewed, we were then cleared and then indoctrinated into the Royal Corps of Signals. And I was in uniform in the Royal Corps of Signals all the time. And then we got a choice of what station we needed to go to.
Right.
So I picked Forfar.
Yeah.
Near Aberdeen, near where I come from, you know. So I was posted there.
Did you do basic training at Arkley?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I was in the ATC and I'd reached a speed of 12 words a minute in Morse. So when we went to Arkley, the first thing we had to do was get our Morse speed up.
Yeah.
And we got it up to 25, 26 words a minute.
Oh my God. Oh,
some got it up higher. And once we'd done that, then we were put on training on the receivers to intercept. And they give us all practice. Well, intercept German army, mainly intercepts. But there, you had to learn all the Q codes.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the Q code?
Yeah.
Do you know it?
I don't know.
But I was going to test you. yeah, the Q codes and the Z code as well. And we had to learn a little bit of German. Just if something came up, you'd know what it meant, you know, not a lot. And it took some time to manipulate the receivers and learn how to use them and to get the correct frequency. And a lot of people didn't pass. But anyway, that went on for quite a long time, probably 4 or 5 months. We had to be able to locate transmissions, and then we were taught that the left ear was the control, like Berlin, and the other ear was occupied countries, like France, all the countries that Hitler had occupied.
So in one ear, you've got the orders given.
The left ear was the Berlin, and the right ear was the outstations.
Yeah.
That was the occupied countries, and that was the commanders from general, colonels, whatever. They had access to Enigma, you see. At Forfar, we had many, many intercept operators. So when we found a station, they did a DF, direction finding. Every station had a direction finding station beside them. Only a little one, like a hut. And they used what's called a goniometer and used that. And our signal went to that DF station.
Right.
But you'd appreciate one line wouldn't be enough.
No.
You couldn't tell. So when I was at Forfar, one at Scarborough took direction finding line with the goniometer, and where they crossed, that's where the wanted station was.
Ah, right.
That would be the wanted station, and most of the ones in Germany were already known. But these other outstations might move from A to B and so forth. So that's how they located them. Once located, they were put on a card index. And the people in charge of the card index, they did all that work. Have you heard of discrim? You may have heard of it.
It's
discrimination. And they checked, discriminated where each station was, filed it in the card system, so that when we went on duty, we were given a card. And that card had the control frequency and the outstation frequency.
So you could find it again.
Yeah, find it. We might have 3 or 4 stations intercepting the same transmissions because they were highly important. They were ultra secret. Mm. And the reason for 4 stations, say that's Aberdeen, that's Scarborough, and that's St. Erth down in Cornwall. Well, you'd get a signal coming to Aberdeen. There might be a storm coming across.
Of course. I know Aberdeen. My granddad lived there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
All my cousins lived in Aberdeen. and I went to school in Montrose. I know we could speak about anything else. Anyway, now Aberdeen, you got a signal coming from Germany to Aberdeen or from Egypt to Aberdeen. Now, these other three have the same signals, but there's one difficulty. Aberdeen may have had bad atmospherics because of a storm coming across the water, so they weren't getting a full transmission. There weren't five-letter, five-figure groups, so they were missing some because of the atmospherics. But Scarborough, for one of the other three, they might be getting the full or most of the messages coming through. And between the four of them, the decryptors here were able to match them all together and get near enough 99% for the whole message.
Oh, my God.
And that happened to the ultra secret. And this might be of interest to you, that our logs were made ultra secret. Now, you've heard of ultra here. We didn't know what ultra meant. On the intercept stations, we weren't told what ultra meant, but ultra meant top secret.
Really. Yeah.
Do you want to ask me any questions? I'm doing all the talking.
No, that's fine. That's what we want to hear. All our listeners want to hear you. They want to know what life was like.
Yes. Well, we did shift work there, and it was midnight to 8, 8 till 4 in the afternoon, and then 4 till midnight, three-shift system. And we were at Forfar. We were in huts. And so, of course, we had to stay there and get up and off to work and back. But we did get a day or two off during the week. But then we used to go out to Montrose and different places when we had a break.
For a sneaky night out.
We had a night out, yeah. But remember, we were very young. I was recruited at the age of 17.
Were you?
I'm now 91. I'm 92 in November. And I'm one of the youngest here, you'll find.
What was it like at the age of 17 to join up?
Oh, at 17? Well, during the war, I was sent out to work on a farm, and I hated it.
Did you?
I hated every minute. Now, I was at school, and when we were 13, 14, we were taken out of school to work on farms.
Right.
Because too many ships were being sunk at that time. So I was sent out to work in a farm. Our schooling practically went down the drain. You know, I picked up afterwards in ways, but they wanted the farms. They wanted the corn, the wheat, the barley, mainly potatoes, and all the vegetables, like turnips and beetroot, all that, were shipped down south. I was in the ATC. I volunteered for the RAF. I passed all the exams, and including the thing you sit on, I forget its name now.
Like a simulator.
Yeah, that's it, that's it. But I failed.
Oh, no.
I got a blockage in my nose. And they operated in Dundee, and that failed. So I couldn't go flying because you had to wear a mask.
Yeah.
And that would have been the end of me. So a man from Montrose, near Aberdeen, came to the ATC flight and asked if anybody would be interested in coming down to London to do some secret work. Well, I've always wanted to go to London. I love London. So I volunteered straight away. Well, the agricultural people tried to stop me, but luckily it was higher security grade, so I was accepted down here. So I came down at 17 years of age in October, and then it took till January to get me cleared.
Yeah.
I got cleared, got in uniform, and I'd already done all the tests and things. I was cleared early from a security side of view, but this was the agricultural people were saying they want all them on their farms, you know.
Yeah.
And
so you were in London from the October till the January?
I was in London from October to January. At 18, I'd passed everything and been posted to Forfar. And then when that closed down and the war ended, I volunteered again to go to Egypt.
Did you?
A place called Sidi Bish. And we were working there. But I don't think I can tell you what I did there.
Okay.
I can't, not in Egypt.
No, that's fine.
I'd be in a lot of trouble. I think I would from somebody anyway.
Let's not get in trouble.
Anyway, what happened was King Farouk, and we had a very rude song about King Farouk. I'm not telling you on that.
You can tell me later.
He kicked us out. He said, get out. So I had to get out, came home, and I went to Barnet for a while, and after the war, I became a station radio officer.
Right.
We went to Malta, then to Cyprus, and then back to Bletchley again, you know. And I stayed there till I retired. The reason I came to Bletchley was not because I did like teaching them, but because I didn't have to do shift work. Because all the time I was abroad at Forfar and Egypt, everywhere abroad, I had to do shift work. Then I just trained people up, you know, did a bit of training. And that was all in Morse. Now Morse is finished and it's all IT, which my daughter here is an expert in IT. It's all IT now and all Facebook and names I don't really go for or understand.
Yeah.
But during the war, I met my wife. And so we met just before I went to Egypt. And then when I came home, I didn't think she'd see me again. And she did. And we got married in 1948. And she died 2 years ago after 68 years married. Yeah. Son and daughter. And I've got two great-grandchildren here. But I've got one of my grandchildren here. So I've got five grandchildren and six great-grandchildren, aren't I?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big family then.
Oh, lovely family. They're huge. They really are.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.